Welcome to this bonus episode of The Art of the Exit. I'm Alex Sugg. In our last episode, we went inside the controversial story of Edward Snowden, the man behind one of the biggest intelligence heists in history. This bonus episode is a new interview with Michael B. Kelly. He's an expert on Snowden and has been covering the story ever since the leaks started going public. Snowden's recent book release raised a ton of new questions, so I had to get Michael in the studio to address some of those, as well as some more questions I had about his online persona from years past. Michael, thanks for jumping back in the studio. I wanted to ask you a few more questions and talk a little bit more about Snowden. He's had a little bit of a busy week, at least comparatively to a normal week the past 6 years for Snowden. His book that he wrote came out, and I want to start there. I have a few things I want to go over with you based on our last episode, but I want to start with the book. First off, first impressions. You've read the book, I know, once for sure, but I imagine you've skimmed through multiple times since. What do you think of the book so far?
I enjoyed it overall. He is much more likable in print, actually, than when he's speaking to crowds. He's got a bit of an edge to him when he's kind of on the giant screen and making his arguments, whereas in print, you know, short of a few typos or misplaced commas that I marked up, it's pretty clean and it's humanizing. So for someone like me who's delved into the biographical details, you learn a lot, and you learn a lot about his perspective of why he did what he did. And my big thing is that there are some topics that are missing that I was looking forward to hearing his thoughts on. And also the book kind of ends pretty abruptly. Mm-hmm. It ends on August 1st, 2013, which is the day he was given his first temporary asylum pass and walks out of the Sheremetyevo airport and into Russia. After that, you know, there's a chapter on Lindsay Mills, is his partner, now wife's, diary entries, and then a chapter called Love and Exile, where he kind of talks about his life, but the point at which he starts talking about his life and then the sentence, "That's my life," is less than a page.
Interesting. And that's kind of funny because, like, our episode from the episode before this one about Snowden, we kind of talked mostly about him before everything kind of broke, and we were trying to talk about who was Snowden before he became this massive deal. But it's interesting because I think a lot of people wonder what the heck has he been doing in Russia for the last 6 years, and it's a little disappointing that he wouldn't go into more detail about that, but it also makes a lot of sense that he wouldn't.
It's understandable. But of course, that is the big question, and it's some of the onus is on him of how much he wants to let us know what's going on outside of just kind of blanket denials or, you know, certain supporters criticizing people who are asking those questions about, hey, you say that you entered the Terminal F when you got to the airport and you were told by a security guard to follow them at passport control, but there are eyewitness accounts saying that you were taken off the side of the plane. So what happened once you were taken off the side of the plane and taken into custody that way and basically everything after that, we still don't know even after the book.
Yeah. Something kind of funny happened. Well, it could be considered funny. I thought it was a little bit. The U.S. government, they're suing Snowden for this book. Well, you kind of broke that this week, a story on Yahoo Finance. But will you talk about what exactly all the implications of that? What are they looking for? Just explain that.
So the day that the book came out on Tuesday, September 17th, the U.S. government filed a civil lawsuit against Snowden and named the publisher Macmillan defendant of sorts, a defendant only in the sense that they were going to try to seek redress through the publisher. So basically, they were suing Snowden for breach of contract and fiduciary obligations, and it's because he signed 6 total secrecy agreements, 3 with the CIA, 3 with the NSA, saying that basically he would not attempt to profit from knowledge that he was entrusted with within these agencies without first going through a pre-publication review for the book or kind of – I'm not exactly sure how they do it for speeches and stuff, but you're also supposed to give them a heads up on speeches and stuff. Oh. And they're supposed to clear it. And he obviously didn't do any of that. So the suit actually in the introduction of the lawsuit, it says we're not seeking to restrain or block the distribution or sale of the book. They're not trying to censor it or block it. They're saying that in this contract, he very clearly lays out that that Snowden signed six times that, you know, if I go forward with this without the U.S. government's consent or without this pre-publication review, then all royalties and profits from that work belong to the government. And so the government is basically like, here's this technicality. We now get those profits. And, you know, it's on – since Snowden lives abroad, that's why they bring in the publisher and say they want a judge to actually say he breached the contract. They get the profits.
What do you think will happen?
I'm not a lawyer, but it's a pretty –
sounds pretty compelling.
It's a pretty well-written lawsuit. Yeah. They quote the contracts which he signed saying – and this is a very basic process. I mean Snowden was kind of getting dunked on Twitter by other intelligence – former intelligence official who had written books and gone through this process, the pre-publication review, because Snowden was suggesting – that you know the government was trying to censor the book or, this book must be pretty hot because they're trying to do this. And the former officials are saying, no, you just signed the contract and you didn't actually go through the pre-publication review. You know, some of these people have to sue the government, which they still respect. They have to sue the government to get their books released. It just happened to Nada Bakos, a former CIA officer. You know, that is the process and everyone knows the process. Mm-hmm. And obviously, you know, Snowden's not one to follow these processes.
It's not as simple or silly as he like just didn't think about it, right? He probably knew this was coming or did he not?
He should have known this was coming, but the part of the lawsuit after they go for the book aspect, which is pretty cut and dry, they go after the speeches as well. And I reported with Michael Iskov of Yahoo News in 2016 that Snowden was making hundreds of thousands of dollars on these speeches. And the U.S. government never really went after that. We got emails from these colleges who were paying Snowden to speak, including University of Colorado, Ohio State. Any public school, we could get the records. And the emails are talking about how they're worried that the U.S. government is going to come after that stuff and how this could be illegal, but the government really never tried that. Mm. So maybe he thought that, you know, he could publish the book too and get away with it. I would assume he had some sort of contingency. The publisher, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what the publisher says.
It'd be crazy if they just took a massive loss on the Snowden book or something based on without knowing any of those things that he had signed in the past. That's crazy to think about.
Yeah.
I want to talk to one of the big a lot of people after hearing our first episode about Snowden. I noticed a lot of people had asked me and written in saying they want to know more about we talked a lot at the end. We didn't talk a lot about, but we mentioned at the end his online presence, Wolf King, Awesome Fox, and the True Hoo-Ha. Will you – I just want to talk a little bit about – people wanted to know more about him online. And I know that there's a lot of interesting depth there. And I just think it would be a fun way to talk about Snowden pre all these things. Who was he online? Let's dig into some of those fun stories. And what maybe start between those two names, mm-hmm. the True Hoo-Ha versus Wolf King, Awesome Fox.
Yeah, so I should note off the top that he speaks in general terms about the internet and the internet being a place where you can anonymize yourself and kind of be a jerk sometimes. But he doesn't actually address specific posts at all. So he also hasn't denied he's pretty cagey when talking about the True Hoo-Ha. It's kind of like a wink and a nod. it's pretty clearly that this was him. The True Hoo-Ha is a name that when he logged onto the Ars Technica forums in his first post was December of 2001 when he's 18 years old. That's just his kind of his screen name. That was his name in like the live chats as well. But the forum is the 730 posts that I had that are still actually public on the internet if you log in yourself and know where to look. Wolf King Awesome Fox is this moniker that he gave himself one day. It's really just one post, but it encapsulates so much of his personality. Him being a gamer, him encouraging folks in the Ars community, him being kind of being defiant and rising above. It's just to me, it fits a lot of who Edward Snowden was back then, and kind of the foundation of who he became. And in terms of the general swaths of what those posts told us, a lot of it was that he railed against things like the record associations. He was fine with pirating video games. He says things like, I don't believe in video games that are made solely to make money. So it's kind of young person, kind of naive. Even in the book, I think he mentions that he doesn't use credit cards anymore, so he ends up pirating a lot of things still. So that's still part of his life. It's a place where he had most of his social education. In the book, he talks about how he basically gave up on school when he was 12 years old. Yeah. As we talked about before, when he was 15, he got mono, knocked him out for 3 months, and he never went back. He talks about that a bit. And he talks about kind of staying up all night to be on the computer and play video games and then sleeping during the day. School was just kind of an afterthought, or extracurricular, as he puts it. It just becomes clear online that that was his true education. As a social environment, this young, scrawny kid could be whoever he wanted, and he was very aggressive. He stood out as being someone who was putting people down and things like that. So it kind of allowed him to be the person he wasn't in the world. Online kind of opened up those opportunities for him.
Yeah. I'll delete this. That's not anything unusual. I mean, there are lots of trolls out there still, and people who use the internet anonymously to be, they kind of signal a new toughness or a new strength or something when you're behind a screen that maybe you don't have in your day-to-day life. The Wolf King Awesome Fox, he only made the one post as that moniker, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah, it was just that one very inspired kind of almost poem. It's a forum thread that he started himself, and I don't think it really went anywhere. I'd have to go back, but it was really just a statement. He just wanted to make this statement. And at that point, it was right before he turned 25. He's an adult. And even into his NSA years in the declassified assessment that we talked about last time, they mentioned that he would come into work late. Because he would tell his boss that he was up playing video games. So the fascinating thing, it's not so much to kind of look at his internet postings and judge him for it or anything. It's really a way to observe certain parts of his personality that continued to blossom up to, you know, into years later, because it wasn't actually that long ago that he was posting this stuff.
Right. That's true. I feel like when we look back at the time, I'm like, that's not that long ago when all this was taking place.
Yeah, his last post on Ars Technica was about a dead man switch. So what happens if I die? Where do I put this information so that it's released? And people can read into that and say he was thinking about...
Wait, dig into that. What is that?
A dead man switch.
No. Like, what is he writing about it, though?
He asks a lot of questions on there that some are related to work. How do I build this script so I can automate this? And he talks about in the book that he automates a lot of stuff with scripts. So there's definitely a overlap between the work he was doing and his social life on Ars, which is fascinating if you think about it, because he was working as a contractor for the CIA and then NSA. He was a CIA technician during some of this time, during a very active time on Ars Technica for a period here. It kind of fit his realm of things that he would ask about something like that. It's kind of technical, and this was a quasi-technical community. And that was May of 2012. So only a couple months before he allegedly began stealing documents. So there is really an arc from once he starts posting on this when he's 18 to when he stops posting on this right before he turns 30, and then right before he turns 29, and then right when he turns 29, he starts stealing documents, allegedly, from the NSA.
Gotcha. So repeat what you said about him wanting to automate this. You said a death switch?
Oh, so a dead man switch.
Dead man switch.
And I'm not a technical expert, but a dead man switch is basically that I'm going to put a certain amount of information in a place, and if I die or if it is registered that I am dead, then this box opens. So the dead man switch. If I'm a dead man, the switch is hit. Hmm. This is something that, people who – it's protection in a way. I can't think of a time where people in history that someone used this specifically, but it's a kind of insurance.
Mm-hmm.
Glenn Greenwald, one of the reporters who works with Snowden, and Snowden himself have said things after it came, everything came out, had said things like, if anything ever happens to him, then this stuff is going to be spread around. So that is basically the threat of a dead man switch. Like, we have a dead man switch here that if you try to kill this guy, which they were never going to do, but if you try to kill this guy, then this stuff is going to be spread out.
Mm, interesting. And you think, or maybe you don't think personally, but people have wondered about the switch. They looked at it on the forums and they thought, is this him planning something?
I've asked technical experts, even former systems administrators, about some of these more technical posts. That one even isn't even the most interesting one. There's one where he's asking about if he can launch a virtual machine inside a live CD. So again, I'm not a technical expert, but basically a live CD is something you put in a CD-ROM and it gives you an operating system. A virtual machine is something that you can load onto something and it will have its own RAM and memory. So basically, it's not on the computer. You're a ghost user. And if you add these two things together, then you are a kind of a ghost user. And I ask former hackers about this and they say, well, you know, he could just have really good hygiene and just not want his fingerprints on things. Or you can load a bunch of hacking tools onto that virtual machine, put it on the live CD, use those hacking tools, and no one's ever going to see you.
Right.
So it's ambiguous. For that particular post, he was at the tail end of his troubled CIA career. So it's intriguing. I would be very curious what government investigators think of the timing of all that.
Yeah.
But it's not clear that it had anything to do with his day-to-day government work.
Gotcha. I think the last question, just to close out this bonus episode, as I become more and more interested in the story, the more I've gotten to talk to you about it, and I know you're an expert on it. You've spent so much time in this world. If you were granted 10 minutes to sit across the table from Edward Snowden, how would you use that time?
Would he have to tell me the truth? I'd have to say no. Like, he wouldn't have to tell me the truth. So that whenever you're interviewing someone and they don't have to tell you the truth, that's going to change the nature of your questions. So I have a list here of things not mentioned in his book, which are things that I'd be fascinated about. And there are certain questions that you can ask that even if you're being lied to, it's an answer.
So I'd be a little illuminating.
Yeah. So just looking at this list, you know, one thing is that arguably the biggest leak in terms of it looking bad for Snowden is him leaking information to the South China Morning Post, not to an American journalist. It was actually an Australian journalist, and not about U.S. Civil liberties at all or domestic surveillance. It was about NSA operations in China. So this is when Bill Binney, the former NSA mathematician, famously said he's transitioning from a whistleblower to a traitor because this didn't have anything to do with his stated aim. And he doesn't talk about these interviews at all in the book, but he provided extra documents. And he even told this journalist, I didn't give this information to the American journalist because I have to go through it and I have more of it. And I need time. If I have time, I would like to make sure it goes to other journalists. And he doesn't touch on that. So pressing him on that is important because we have in his own words that he had this more information and he was providing this stuff. He's defended those leaks before. So like I would on a scale of five, I would put that in the 3.5 range. Another big thing, and I actually got a chance to ask Edward Snowden this question at the Chaos Computer Club conference in the end of 2017. I flew to Germany, and he was on the screen, and they provided one question, and I was sitting in the front row to get that one question, and I asked him, Snowden, you know, Mr. Snowden, Russian President Vladimir Putin has said on multiple occasions that you visited with Russian officials in Hong Kong. Can you speak to that, basically? And unfortunately, his sound cut out. He said, I can't hear you, but I think the question has something to do with the Russians. And everyone starts laughing. So I would definitely follow up with my question about that and try to get a straight answer.
Sound conveniently.
Yeah, I even went to the technical guys after because, like, I'm at this conference. I got nothing better to do. I went to the technical guys, and they said, you know, it seemed like he could hear fine.
Yeah.
We didn't have any issues.
Yeah, it's so, a convenient time for
it
to drop out.
Yeah, plausibly deniable for him to not be able to hear that question.
Right.
And then I would put that as a 4.5. That's an important question of, like, why did he reach out to Russian officials in Hong Kong, you know? That raises a lot of questions. And you know, it's a very fair question because why would the Russians allow this guy to fly there unless they had some sort of agreement in place? Mm. So that's an important aspect of that's missing from the book and also missing from the general story. Questions about his life in Russia because his explanation of we went through passport control. We met with a FSB official. The FSB official tried to get me to work with them. I said no. We were stuck in the airport for 40 days. And after that, I guess they didn't want me and the international press clogging their airport anymore, so they let me go. And then it ends. That's not very compelling or convincing at all. So pressing him on Why the book ends so abruptly is another thing that I would definitely want to try to squeeze in. I mean, if I had to pick one of those, since I only had 10 minutes, I would definitely go with the conversations with Russian officials in Hong Kong.
Back to the airport thing. Wasn't there, because he was there for however many days, over 30, right?
It was like 39
days.
Like that,
yeah. But you had said, like, different reporters and people had flown there, right, to try and find him somewhere in the terminal, and that no one could find him.
Yeah. So that's a great observation. So they said at the time that they were staying in the transit zone. An international airport like Sharma Tevo is going to have a transit zone where they have transit capsules. Sarah Harrison said, you know, no shower for this whole time. And like we were there, but they weren't really stuck in the transit zone because, as you said, there were reporters and stuff searching for him there. He was being held in a restricted part of the airport. There are a couple of statements in Russian media that I found with sources from the airport being like, Mr. Snowden has been moved from the recreation room. And the recreation room is like the room for where on-duty officers hang out, kind of like their coffee room. And the security services in Russia have basically a wing of this airport. This is where he gave the July 12th press conference, which he also doesn't talk about in the book. The staged July 12th press conference where he thanks these countries for standing up to the United States and at the end, when pressed, asks for asylum in Russia. This was held in a restricted area of the airport. So he wasn't really, you know, in the transit zone, and we can't even say 100% positive that he was in the airport
all 39 days.
He was very quickly taken to the restricted zone, and then he was out of sight.
Gotcha. Okay. Maybe as a closing thought, is there anything else, listeners, anything that you think you'd want to finish on? Like, with all of this, with this book coming out, what's coming up? What are your thoughts on everything moving forward?
After I finished the book and kind of sat on it and thought about it, one thought I had is that this is interesting, and the book that picks up where this book leaves off is going to be even more interesting. So the book that touches on this and then has the ability to detail what happens after August 1st, 2013 and tells the rest of the story is going to be even more interesting, because this is a story about the great game. This is a story about espionage, really. This is a post-Cold War Russia-U.S. spy story. At the end of the day, this is what it's going to be. You're probably going to need people, the U.S. to know, even the U.S. government to know more about this. The best case scenario is high-level Russian officials or intelligence officials who know of the Snowden situation to defect. That's what happened after the Cold War ended. Some officials in the 90s defected to the U.S. and the U.S. learned a lot. Then you also have the Mitrokhin archive, which is the largest, basically an archivist took out a bunch of documents and took them to London, KGB documents. And the book is incredible. It's probably the single most informative document or book, you know, thousands of documents about the KGB. And that's what you're going to have with the Snowden situation, is that there's Snowden in the leaks and what he exposed of post 9/11 surveillance and what that meant in the reforms. And that's still, that conversation is still going on. You have Snowden, the man, the person who did all this and why he did that. And this book is very good for that. And then you have Snowden, the former intelligence official who, for whatever reason, flew to Russia and lives there to this day and for the foreseeable future. And that is a story that hasn't been told yet. And so, you know, there's still intrigue out there.
Michael B. Kelly, thanks for being on the podcast, man.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to The Art of the Exit from Yahoo Finance. Please leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts if you enjoyed this bonus episode.